All right, welcome back to the Middle Tech Podcast Spotlight Series. You've got Evan Knowles and Logan Jones here. We're sitting down with Nick of Shadow Ventures. Today, we're going to talk about Nick's background, where he comes from. He's from Kentucky, what we call a boomerang. You left for a little while and came back.
Back, just like everyone else.
So we're looking forward to diving into that decision and what you do at Shadow and talking a bit about prop tech and real estate and kind of the built world, which is where you all focus. So thanks for joining and making the trip to Lexington. Yeah.
Appreciate you guys having me. What a cool setup.
Yeah, this is an awesome space. Shout out to JP.
Shout out to JP for that one. I got to ask at the top here. So you went to the University of Florida, right?
I did.
You have a score prediction for our football team this year?
Ooh. You know, honestly, it's been a tough last couple of years for UF. Was it last year when we lost for the first time in like 30 years to you guys?
That was 3 years
ago.
That
was a while ago. That was two, 3 years
ago. That was a big night in Lexington.
I'm showing you how poor my knowledge is, but that was a pretty devastating night in my life. That was like my one trump card over all Kentucky fans here. So fun fact, I get asked a lot. So born and raised in Louisville, and I don't know that you guys know this, but both my parents went to UL, huge Louisville fan. My grandparents had season tickets basically, you know, when I was a little kid, and was a big part of my upbringing was like going to Freedom Hall for basketball games. And you know, we'll forever be a fan for that reason. But I get asked a lot, like how I ended up at Florida. And, one was like the obvious reasons, the weather. They actually had a pretty good business program. Big school, wanted the full college experience. But the other like subconscious factor was that they always did well against Kentucky, and I was always cheering against Kentucky growing up. So like I had a positive brand affinity with the school, and like honestly, I don't know that I would have ended up at Florida if they hadn't just like outperformed Kentucky in many different attributes. So
yeah, that crazy win streak that was finally broken.
But like in basketball, God, they were always really competitive.
Yeah,
they were good Gator.
We're just not. Just not becoming a football school.
Yeah.
Anyway,
football was like the easy way to bully UK fans growing up was the Florida streak.
Before highlighting our sponsors, we'd just like to state that the views and content shared on this platform do not necessarily reflect those of our show sponsors. Middle Tech is presented by KY Innovation, the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development's Office of Entrepreneurship. KY Innovation exists to support and develop Kentucky's startup ecosystem, and we are proud to be supported by an organization whose mission aligns so closely with ours. If you're a founder building in Kentucky, you need to check out the resources that KY Innovation has to offer. You can find more information by clicking the link in our show notes or going to kyinnovation.com.
Middle Tech is sponsored by Bolt Marketing. Take your website to the next level with a website that's built to work. At Bolt Marketing, they're revolutionizing websites for small businesses that are affordable, customizable, and hassle-free. Whether you have a construction company, a boutique clothing store, or you own a hot yoga studio, they have options for you. Click the link in our show notes to explore their marketing options that can transform your marketing and grow your business. And as a personal note, Bolt Marketing built our website, and they were awesome to work with throughout the entire process. We highly recommend working with.
Yeah, well, let's kick off by talking a little bit about your background. So you mentioned you went to Florida. Let's kind of pick it up after you graduated. What did you get into? And then let's take that into Shadow Ventures.
Yeah, so a little bit of a circuitous background, which I think is like probably true for a lot of VCs. I actually studied finance in school and went to work for a bank post my UF experience. I worked for Raymond James based in St. Pete, Tampa area. And I was essentially, telling this story to an investor yesterday. I was essentially a 22-year-old kid post 2008 when the regulatory environment was pretty intense, calling financial advisors. I worked on the financial services side in compliance and was kind of analyzing. My job was to analyze their trades and to flag them when something was, when their behavior was not appropriate, basically when they were turning over mutual funds quickly to generate fees, when they were making trades that were not suitable for the risk preferences with specific clients. And it was an interesting time because none of that had been scrutinized like over the course of the previous probably couple decades. And so it was the first time that these like really successful financial people were getting told like, hey, you can't do that anymore, like how they generated a lot of income over the years. And I was a 22-year-old kid scared shitless to like pick up the phone and tell this really successful person like, hey, you need to listen to me. You can't do this or you're going to get fired. And so was it really, I mean, it's a really challenging job as you can imagine. But I realized early on, I wasn't going to be great at crunching numbers on a spreadsheet and looking at dashboards and being a true like day-to-day financial analyst. I was good at going deep in certain topics. Like I liked the equity research component when I got exposed to it. That's a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a part of the job now. But I knew that I needed something. I liked finance, but I needed something a little bit more qualitative, something more creative that was probably more on the business operating and even the revenue generation side was exciting to me. And both of my parents, so my dad is a home builder. I grew up on a job site more or less. Like, you know, my first jobs are always cleaning his job sites up and working with the subs and all of that. And I ended up leaving the bank after a couple of years and went to work for the family business and cut my teeth in as an adult in construction. And what I learned or what I observed when I went back to work for the business was there is literally zero technology being used on these job sites. And I was working on residential jobs here in Kentucky. I mean, my dad's in Louisville, right? So, you know, he was building mostly high-end, built-to-suit homes. It wasn't like, you know, the Pulte Home Factory or the Lennar or the Toll Brothers factory where like efficiency was actually really important. He was building more custom high-end homes. So a little bit of a different thing, but I saw enough. Like I knew there's something wrong with the adoption in construction specifically. And so I kind of became the quasi innovation guy. And I wasn't a very technical person at the time. And, you know, it is something that I still think is not like being technical is not my top skill set. But I became interested enough to want to learn about technology and specifically the behavioral patterns of like why was this S curve moving so slow in terms of adoption? And so that path led me to finding a resource based in Chicago. It's called Built Worlds. And Built Worlds was essentially a new age media company that was devoted to like finding that exact answer. Like how do we educate the real estate and construction industries in particular and get them to be more willing, get them to view technology as a less friction-filled cost-filled endeavor that actually could give them a meaningful competitive advantage in their business. And that was because that was how I was using tech for my dad. I was using it to help our selling process, help back office efficiency. I mean, I'm talking like even basic stuff at the time, like really basic software. But at first it was like, let's just get stuff in spreadsheets because like this stuff exists on pen and paper. And like, I have no way of, if I'm pricing a project, I have no way of like drawing from past experiences because I'm not sifting through like folders to look for this data. Like, and by the way, like, is that data even accurate? Like this is like one subcontractor's perspective on pricing. So like, you know, it's a very relationship driven business. There's a lot of trust involved. And the interesting thing about adding tech is like you actually start to get really objective feedback on maybe things that you weren't paying attention to before when you're looking at a full dashboard of your costs, your estimated project expenses, and then ultimately what the revenue would be. So it was a moment in time in the construction space where like that stuff really mattered because things weren't moving in volume. So like your one or two projects that you had going for, you know, a custom builder per year, or, you know, 5 to 10, 10 to 15, those projects and the profitability really mattered. And people were coming off of an experience where they had to eat lots that they owned and sell them for half the price that they bought them. And like, so no one's, they were not, their pockets were not lined with cash. So it was looking back, it was a time, like that timing really mattered for me to go down that journey. But long story short, I ended up at Built Worlds, talking with the founder of the company, who was also a son of a construction firm, and really appreciate his vision. It was like, let's educate this market on why tech is fantastic and like bring them into the 21st century. And that was kind of my whole mission. So I went to help him out and joined the company to lead sales and marketing, primarily a marketing focused gig. I had to enter the startup world with, you know, a focus. I didn't have a ton of experience then, but I had proven that I could figure out the marketing stuff, and eventually grew to like, we did research content, kind of owned that. That was within my camp. Journalistic content, events, we monetize via events, so programming those events out and bringing in speakers. And so I met, bringing this back to Shadow Ventures, I met my now partner, KP Reddy, who's the founder of Shadow Ventures. He was the first keynote at our venture-oriented conference at Built Worlds, and he just spoke on the topic of serial entrepreneurship and interesting startups within the built environment landscape. And we can, you know, dig into our thesis a little bit if you want, given that that's like a key component to what we're doing at the venture capital firm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you all have definitely focused heavily on prop tech, just real estate in general, but especially the built world. And it's definitely a fascinating space. You know, as somebody that's been building in prop tech, just like it sounds like construction, you know, it's heavily lagging as far as technology adoption for a lot of reasons. Very fragmented demographics. You know, there's a lot of things that affect, you know, innovation adoption within the industry. So, you know, I imagine that's a unique thesis. There's definitely a lot of niche, there's definitely niche VCs within the prop tech and kind of software space for residential, but you guys are focused more heavily on just the built environment, correct? So yeah, so dive into that thesis.
Yeah, so the built environment, for us, that definition is anything that's affecting the value chain and designing, constructing, and then maintaining the world's physical infrastructure. So buildings, primarily through the lens of primarily buildings, but also physical infrastructure, bridges, roads, more civil-oriented things, even along the lines of energy, utilities, air, airport, rail. Those are things that we touch too. But technologies that are supporting the designing and building, primarily of all those markets, is kind of what we look at. So it ends up being like, a lot of people think we're sector focused. Like, we're not just a construction tech VC. We're not just a pure prop tech VC. And those are, you know, there's a lot of firms that focus just on those markets. So we view ourselves as thematically focused, which is, you know, the theme of how do we support better buildings and, you know, a better physical environment for humans across the world. So it's definitely a bigger ambitious market. And, you know, like, rough scale in that market is, it's like, represents 20% of GDP per year. It's like production for those markets. So pretty massive footprint, and obviously really critical. Like, people, these are the places that we live, work, and play in. If these things aren't built correctly, obviously there's a lot of risk. There's been bridge collapses we've seen. There's been building collapses from, you know, poor structural engineering. And I think everyone knows the risk of not building correctly. And so the reality is that market, because of the risk involved, because of the size and scope of and the cost of these projects, it's a really, really nuanced investment landscape, because the startup building technology for these industries, it's mission critical technology, right? It's not like, hey, if we mess up, you know, a number in a SaaS, you know, CRM, you know, mess up our reporting for a week, that's not super critical. Like, we can fix that. It's a bug in the software. If we mess up the math on a structural grade skyscraper, a lot of people die. So there's not as much. There's like a little, like, we have a much heavier MVP building lift when you're a founder in our space. And Evan, you're a founder in the prop tech space. I think you kind of know a little bit of what I'm referring to. But the seriousness of, like, these are people's homes, these are people's offices. These are the roads that we drive on, you know, and trust that we're going to be able to make it home safely. And so anyway, I we just want to convey the size and the importance of the market. And relatively speaking, there's not a ton of other VCs out there that are covering this beat, if you will, in the way that we are. And we're typically, we like to play in deeper technology. Like, we've done pure play software, but we've also done hardware. We've done a couple robotics deals. We've done a couple material science deals, and we're trying to solve like really hard problems. And like my description kind of alludes to why. But that's a little bit of the focus, is like, we want to be pure play technology VC and be the specialist that, hey, if you're a founder building in this market, like, I need this guy on my cap table, this team on my cap table, because these guys know the market. They can get me customers. They know that they're gonna save me a lot of time if I'm building a product in this space. And I like mistakes I might make along the way, not only from a go-to-market perspective, but also like a technical architecture and product perspective too, because there's a lot of idiosyncrasies with building stuff in the market.
Especially, you know, I ran into all of that, you know, with Simba. It's prop tech is not necessarily a space, and I'm sure the built world is exactly the same. It's not necessarily a space you can come in and, you know, barge your way in with a product. You know, doesn't matter how innovative it is. There's a lot of gatekeepers within, I'm sure, both industries, because it's just such a, like you said, mission critical. And when things are mission critical, there's a lot of approvals and hoops to jump through in order to get to market. And so that's one thing that, you know, I've learned that I'm sure, you know, looking back, would have liked to have more. You know, we brought in consultants, but probably would have liked to have more people on the cap table that, you know, had a very vested interest from way earlier on in our life cycle to help us through those things. But where are you all at with the fund? So how many funds have you raised, and kind of what's the team?
At senior associate level and grew to be a partner in this fund. So, in our second fund. And so that's been an exciting thing to kind of make that transition into a GP role in the fund. But I think, you know, in terms of where we're at, we've deployed, just over $22 million in capital since 2019. Started making investments then. Our most notable investment is a 3D printed housing company in Austin called Icon. They were valued in 2022 at over two, like we're just around the $2 billion mark. And
I think I saw them at a conference with a live demo at it was an Autodesk conference. It was pretty cool. It was a similar technology, but they were 3D printing a home with the concrete going around.
It. Yeah. So yeah, they 3D print homes, and they've had a ton of success. I think like, It's a really good, if you're looking for like an example of what we do and the types of deals that get us excited, Icon's a perfect example, like really ambitious idea. I mean, the original thesis was like, we want to build a home for half the time and for half the cost. And like, so essentially solving a lot of the affordable housing issues was the original thesis. And, but the time it takes to build is also a huge downside to housing. And so like the ability to 3D print concrete and get that thing up a lot faster. They've had to work on a lot of the permitting aspects and code requirements, more recently, and they've been successful in getting some of those over the line. So yeah, we're super bullish on them. And I think a lot of other, like, housing is definitely, bringing more housing to the world is definitely a key mission. In an investment bucket that we look at, it's it's definitely a big thematic focus. Is how do we fix a lot of the, like, I think the estimation is 3 billion people will be without housing in 2030. So like, there's the affordable housing element, and then there's like, even more in your world, the increased cost and cost of living and owning a home. We've seen a lot of different opportunities to like start building equity earlier and even for renters. Like, those are, you know, some interesting concepts. But I think breaking down the whole problem set of like, what is working in housing globally here in the US, what's not working. When you start actually looking at that picture, it's not like it's not the most exciting, and it's a pretty bleak scenario for a lot of people who aspire to be homeowners.
Yep.
And so like, that would be a funding area for us, is trying to fix some of those problems.
I am curious. So kind of going back to the building in the real world, and the stakes are very high when you're building a company that's, you know, building a house that people are living in, for example, or building a bridge, whatever it is. I'm curious how that changes how you guys invest your money, do due diligence, support the entrepreneurs that are building the companies. Can you speak to that a little bit in terms of, you know, how are you supporting the companies that are actually you're getting the money to?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's a couple schools of thought in venture that as a founder, if, you know, if any founders are listening here, I think it's important to interview your VCs for this and even, you know, some of the early investors, if they're angels on the cap table, wanting to understand their take on this. And so one of the beliefs is that VCs shouldn't interfere much with investing and like you're betting on the founder and they need to be able to figure it out. And like, you kind of want to get out of their way. The other theory is like, if a founder needs help, the VC should be able to step in and provide and assist in an advisory capacity. Our view even extends further than that. Like, we want to be an extension of the team. Like, we want to be the like one of the first calls if something goes wrong in the business and they don't know who else. Like, being a founder can be lonely, and like, it's tough to if you don't have an equal co-founder, which is a scenario that we see a lot. Like, who do you call? So troubleshooting those issues, but almost too, from like a pure extension of the team, we want to help them through the biggest hurdles, emotional, tactical, you know, strategic, whatever it could be on a day-to-day basis. Like, we're definitely there in that camp. Like, I was just, one of the reasons I was a couple minutes late, I was talking to a founder in the car about, around that they're putting together, and there were just like couple things we saw in docs that were sent over that were just like, hey, here's some basic ways to think about this that I think you should revise in your new series of documents, because I wouldn't be excited about this as an investor. So like, the basic financial advice, but also, you know, more broadly in terms of how we help after, like, immediately post-investment. So our model, because we're thematically focused, most of our investors probably have some skin in the game in our markets, right? So they're real estate developers, they're real estate owners, they're construction firms, they're engineering services companies, a few architects. And the goal is, hey, we've built a pretty large strategic limited partner base for our fund. I think like we're probably 70 to 80% of funds raised at this point are from those types of people, and those companies directly investing off their balance sheet. And they're signing up to pilot the companies we're investing in. And like, we kind of get that implicit agreement when they work with us, is like, hey, you know, there's like a little bit of a two-way street here. They're a limited partner. They can kind of do what they want, but it's an important part of our process. Like, we are trying to catalyze technology adoption in the space. Like, our mission is much bigger than just blindly writing checks and hoping for the best, being passive with it. Like, we know how valuable it is to get early customer agreements if you're a new founder. And so whether that agreement is six or seven figures, it's ideal. If it's, you know, if it's five or six figures just to start, it's still a really credible logo. These are large companies that are investing with us, a lot of brand, you know, a lot of brand association with and social proof with those logos. And so if we can help with that respect of like, hey, this has been verified and validated by credible companies. And then if they like the pilot experience, and assuming things go well, and we try to interface there and make sure that expectations are set and they're delivering on the deadlines and all that, then, you know, it leads to a six or seven figure deal. And that is transformative moving into the next financing round, right? Like, that can essentially make or break the business. And oftentimes it's one or two companies moving forward on those bigger early deals that actually make all the difference. Like, we had a company in the portfolio land a seven figure deal in the last, like, you know, it was basically their first big deal, and it happened in the last month, and it's completely transformative to their business. Like, changes the outlook significantly. And it's one of those things where in our world, you can kind of go from zero to one in that respect, where it's like, if you're selling a product that's that expensive, it's like, again, a mission critical product, B2B oriented product, enterprise sale. It takes a while. Like, it takes a second to build up to that place, and you can get really discouraged when you don't see traction. So we're kind of there interfering, you know, playing interference and helping them kind of navigate those early sales, the timelines for those sales, helping sell when we can. So it's much broader than just like, hey, basic investment advice and passive.
Yeah, I love that model because, you know, especially as a early stage startup, figuring out distribution and sales, just from my experience working at a startup, that's one of the most difficult things to do. And not only that, but finding credible logos that are going to be able to really transform the business like that. That is a really cool model to say, okay, we're going to take money from them that are, they're wanting to invest in innovation and also sign on for saying, okay, we're going to try out and pilot some of these people you're investing in. I think that's an awesome way to be putting money into those companies.
Well, off the back of that, you know, one of the problems that I've read about and have seen play out in prop tech and is if you get strategics involved too early, of course, it's great to have the revenue, large deals. Depending on who the strategic is, it could narrow TAM potentially. How have you guys avoided, you know, misaligned either incentives by having strategics and being a middleman for those strategics and investing in companies? That's a common worry within middle tech within prop tech is, you know, there's, I'm sure in the built world it's different, but I'm sure you can run into that scenario as well.
Yeah.
But how do you all think about
totally
that?
No, it's totally real. The answer is we are the exact answer to those strategic problems.
What I figured. Yeah.
The flow is an LP is a strategic firm. Large corporate, usually a brand name, they invest in our fund and no one knows they're invested in our fund outside of the founders, right? If that same LP went direct, to your point,
they'd be on their cap table.
And you see a huge real estate name or you see a huge construction name and you're selling to their competitors that are directly competitive and with them and hate them. And, or even they play nicely, but like the idea of, you know, someone having the technology, like startup technology venture upside that, you know, they put a couple million bucks in and they can get a $1 billion return or higher in the event of a true outlier. Like that should be scary to a competitive corporate.
Yeah.
And so what you're speaking to, I think, is a really important dynamic for strategic investors. I mean, strategic investors know, you know, they're aware of that. And CVCs, corporate venture capital, like this is something they've always dealt with, is it's like, it can be difficult to get access to the best deals, because of that dynamic, because we've seen this firsthand, by the way, like we've been co-investors with pure strategic, like direct on the cap table, like, hey, I know your name, every potential new investor, or customer might be aware that you're a huge investor. And customers get skittish when they learn about it. It's real.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it can't work and it's not a model that shouldn't be pursued. But I think more so the thought here for founders would be like, be aware of the risks, because I think a lot of founders see, you know, whatever dollar signs that they would be willing to invest and they think it's like a, you know, no-brainer. They're pretty low maintenance. Like there's positive reasons to working with strategics. And one of the ways that strategics get around that potential dilemma is they like are very hands off and they're like the lowest maintenance investor that you'll see. And they're kind of saying like, hey, we're not going to look at data information. Like they try to downplay their entire involvement. Well, we all know like they're actually involved, I think the strategic investing, like, so anyway, part of our value to strategic investors who want to get exposed to venture capital, who want to get, and the main reason they're excited to get exposed and they would want to set up a CVC or want to work with shadow ventures is because they want to learn. They're not looking at, like they're trying to feed the core business. They're not looking to make a new profit center with their venture capital endeavor. There's been like one, I mean, I was talking to my partner KP about this. There's been like one successful CVC in the history of the business. Like that tells you all you need to know. And they're still around because it can be incredibly valuable to a multi-billion-dollar business to learn one strategic insight about one particular company or apply one piece of knowledge that you learned from a strategic category that was created early and take off with that knowledge and use it to your advantage.
Yeah. JLL is one that comes to mind. in that industry. And I know you were talking about themes earlier and affordable housing. You know, I know that climate's another one. So last question here, kind of on shadow and your specific strategy, you know, how do you think about climate investing? Because that's one very important topic to discuss as, you know, a startup environment is how do we solve these big problems, especially as we start to see more and more events and, you know, disasters happen and the frequency is becoming more and more apparent. But also, unfortunately, it's been politicized and people are using data to misinform people. How do you guys navigate that space and make sure that you're making intelligent investments that, you know, aren't, whether good or bad, politicized?
Yeah. I think that exact, so the way that I personally, and so I'll caveat this, these are like my personal opinions and not the opinions of the company.
Yeah.
But my personal opinion is like everything you just described in that dynamic of like the politicization of carbon and climate and, you know, whether or not like want to have the debate of like how important is some of the carbon data that's being reported, how mission critical is like reducing carbon. Like that's an actual conversation people are having. It's an emotional conversation. And so like the way that I view this as an investor is like there's dislocation there because it's an emotional conversation. No one's thinking clearly. And so like when you actually, so the answer is to be objective and scientific about it and to form your own opinions and to not be emotional about the stance that you're investing in. And I'll share a personal experience. I've kind of gone, I've seen both sides, right? Like you allude to, you know, some of the carbon fraud and accounting fraud that occurs and greenwashing and all of that, that's real. Like that happens. There's also like really practical solutions that are like undoubtedly good for the environment. On a, you know, from a climate tech perspective. And like one of those would be like material science, right? Building with better materials that are less carbon intensive, is like a very active way to, invest in more green technology if you're a building owner or if you're a developer, and so that would be what's called embodied carbon into the building. And so you look at that compared to carbon accounting tools, what's a better way to like actually impact the environment? It's like, well, I think the answer is pretty obvious, but that the thing that I get excited about with that particular topic is the emotional variance with it. And I know people will miss some good opportunities because it is an emotional topic. And I think there are a lot of climate tech funds out there, and I think they'll get excited about, there's a potential they get excited about things that aren't actually having a real impact.
Yeah.
And I want to, with our thesis, I want to be really grounded in reality and data on what is actually going to move the needle. And I think, again, for us, it's like, you know, material science and embodied carbon. And then we have a couple investments that would actually help buildings control their energy expenditures. If, you know, for instance, you're working with a really old building, objectively, like fact, old buildings are terrible with energy efficiency. Like you're wasting a ton of energy. And so anyone who's ever lived in an old building or worked in one or like looked at the cost of them, like it's expensive in the winter. It's expensive, you know, when AC is blasting, and it's expensive when you're running your boiler. And so if there's a way to modernize that already existing building, like I think 70% of the existing building stock will need retrofitting in the next 10 years. One of the ways that a lot of people will look to retrofit is electrification, and even, you know, putting electrification as like a potential solution aside, how can I just like reduce my energy cost, and how can I make this building more comfortable for my residents? Old buildings are just also, there's a lot of volatility with the temperature, and it's like, you know, it can be really uncomfortable in the summer and uncomfortable in the winter to live in. So improving the overall customer experience is also a thing. But yeah, I'm excited about climate. I think there's a lot of practical applications out there, but I also, from an investment perspective, I'm like licking my chops because I know people are going to miss it because they're going to get emotional about it.
Yeah. And we definitely have experienced, the state of Kentucky has, you know, lack of objective data and, you know, making decisions high on emotions with, you know, App Harvest. I think that that was a clear example of, you know, went to market with a very emotional call to action and food sustainability and food security and, you know, all of the climate disasters and lack of water. And I think there's a lot of emotion attached to that. And so when they went to market, that objective data wasn't there. And so by the time they IPO'd and did the SPAC, you know, a lot of people were left holding the bag. So I think, you know, we acutely feel, you know, the climate side of the investment landscape right now and kind of what that's been going through and watching that. But speaking of Kentucky, you're here in Kentucky. We mentioned at the beginning you're a boomerang. What brought you back to Kentucky? Talk about that. And then how have you felt now that you're back about the startup ecosystem? As much have you been able to get involved?
Yeah. I'll take a sip of my hillbilly tea while I answer that.
I thought that was kombucha maybe. Is that?
It's a special concoction. It's not what most people think. It's not
moonshine.
Bourbon.
Not bourbon.
Not moonshine or bourbon. It's actually just a ton of herbs. But yeah, I call it my hillbilly tea. Evan, your question, you want to get into more specifically what I think about the landscape in Kentucky?
Yeah, what brought you back? And then so far, yeah, you know, impressions now that you're back of what's happening here?
Yeah. What brought me back was wanting to be closer to family. That was the primary decision. I have a baby now that I'm responsible for. So that changes your priorities a bit. Definitely more than I anticipated. I was in Chicago, lived abroad for a little while when I was younger, and ended up in Chicago, and then most recently in Boulder during, I was there for the pandemic and thought I would be there longer. But after having a baby, your priorities change and you realize the value of grandparents and all those things. But honestly, like more specifically why we landed here, because, you know, our parents are not here. Kentucky has a lot to offer. It's like a really, I think it's a great place to live if you value the things that Kentucky brings, which in my opinion, like the investment case for Kentucky, if you will, is high affordability, really friendly people, great community, accessibility. It's not overpopulated. If you like your space, if you like land, if you like calmness, like maybe it's some of the cheapest land in the country, like exists in the state. And you know, I obviously grew up here. When you get used to the Southern pace, it's something I think you aspire to get back to. Like I've lived in faster pace environments than I was bred to live in, if you will. And I think like there's a reason you find your way back. Like it's the family stuff aside, there is like an attractiveness to, you know, a slower pace. And, you know, I'll say this from an ambitious person perspective. So I've always viewed myself, whether I am or not, I've always viewed myself as an ambitious person. I've chased things. I work in a pretty ambitious industry in venture capital. We have big goals at our firm. I have big goals for myself. And one of the questions I had to ask myself was like, can Kentucky supply me with the things I need for my ambition? And I don't think earlier in my life, I think the answer would have been no. And honestly, there's been a couple of things that have changed in the world that I think have enabled some of those answers to be a yes for me now, which is like, you know, remote work is now a much more acceptable thing. Talent recruiting. So like when we look to grow our firm, for instance, when we look to make investments, like we can look globally. We don't have to be confined to a geography. And I actually think it's like from a venture perspective, it's pretty limiting to, you know, to be just looking at a particular geography. And I think that's why you're seeing like some of the, some other big tech communities blow up. And, you know, Miami is like the obvious place where I think there's been a lot of growth, Austin. But one place, adjacent place, like pulling this back to Kentucky is Nashville. So like Nashville is like, has always been, I think, especially over the last decade, a model for growth for Louisville and I think any big city in Kentucky. And I'm not saying we have to go there. Like, there's some of the attributes that I mentioned about Kentucky that I think are great. And maybe some people don't want an overly populated city with, you know, egregious housing expenses. But I don't know. I want more growth in the state. Like, I think a lot of us do. And I think that, again, there's been an enablement with new working trends, with hybrid work, remote work, that is going to allow a lot more people, ambitious people, to live in Kentucky than previously they would have been able to capture. So, like, a larger market size for the city, Louisville and the state, Louisville and Lexington. And so I think, you know, observation in terms of my, you know, back to what I was saying about the ambition. I think that culturally, you have to work to find really ambitious people in Kentucky. There are a lot of hardworking people, but people who really want to, like, you know, in the technology world, we're looking to build monopolies. I'm looking to fund monopolies. We're looking to really build a really large venture firm. And, you know, we're looking to fund $1 billion, $10 billion businesses. And, like, to have the type of person that is chasing that, usually historically you'll find that in the Bay Area or New York or, you know, some of your type A oriented cities, like, where ambitions in the water. So that was a fear of mine moving back. And I don't think I have, I think being integrated into the tech community here, I don't think I have that fear as much anymore. You have to look a little bit, but it's not hard to find. Like, you can network into circles of ambitious people. And, like, I met a founder today based in Louisville and I was, like, really impressed. I have relatively low expectations and, generally speaking, and, was like, wow, this guy's built a great business, really ambitious guy, fantastic background. He used to live in a major city in the US and is, like, setting up his company here, has over 40 people now. And so seeing, you know, some of that, the traction of, like, for founders to want to actually set up shop here and build, really ambitious companies here, has, like, quelled that fear for me. And I'm definitely optimistic about the reason for more talent to want to end up here, and that we have a good model to follow with in Nashville, for instance. Like, there were a couple, I think, in the last month, venture firms that announced they were setting up offices in Nashville, like, large venture firms. And the question is why? It's like, well, it's now an attractive place to live. And the ambitious, there's enough talent locally, for them to support opening offices in the area, not just funding companies in the area. Their partners want to live there. Their founders want to live there. So, yeah, I think there's, like, a lot of reason to be excited.
Yeah. I think I really relate to what you're saying about the ambition thing. It's much more intentional to go out and find it. It's definitely there. And I think the reason I love living here and the reason I have a lot of conviction to living here now is largely through Middle Tech and working at a startup myself and trying to create, you know, the media and the stories and the connections in the community around people that value that ambition. And I mean, going back, we've been doing this podcast for 4 years now, being able to kind of aggregate all those stories, I think means a lot to me to be able to go to somebody who might be a boomerang who had those same kind of thoughts, mm-hmm. or who is thinking about moving here and not lived here. You know, I think it's one of those things that's like you reach a critical mass and then it's like you're better at storytelling about what your area is all about. And I'm hoping that's what happens in Kentucky, is that we give mainly students from the University of Kentucky, University of Louisville Center, Bellarmine, a reason to want to stay here. I think that's kind of the one of the big levers that we can pull as a state, is how do we give more of our students a reason to stay here? Like, for me, I graduated with really no idea of what I wanted to do, and I had to go out and find the ambitious people and kind of figure out what that opportunity was for me within the tech scene. And I think if we can provide more opportunities for that for our students, I think that's where things really start to get interesting. But to your point, I mean, Nashville, 3 hours away, I think figuring out how we can collaborate more between those two cities. And we're actually going to a conference with UK Innovate tomorrow to talk about collaboration between UK, between Kentucky and Tennessee. So anyway, to conclude that thought there, Totally aligned with what you're saying around coming back to Kentucky and what your hesitations were. But to end things off here, tell us a little bit about where we can learn more about you or Shadow Ventures if anybody listening here wants to look into you guys more.
Yeah, so our great place to start, learn about our portfolio is on our website, shadow.vc, as in venture capital. You can learn more about me through click, you know, we have our team page on the site. I think the links to my LinkedIn and Twitter account are within that profile page on our website. But on I sometimes tweet. I've actually not been super active on Twitter, but I'm at P Nick Durham on Twitter. Sometimes share thoughts there. But yeah, LinkedIn, feel free to, you know, reach out on LinkedIn if you want to have a conversation. And yeah, again, looking to meet like-minded, ambitious people in town. So please reach out if you're interested.